The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujak, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
With each new story about climate change, the news about our environment can be alarming and even overwhelming. The reason, of course, is we just don't know where we are headed as temperatures rise around the world. But might there be clues left behind from earlier warming periods in our Earth's history that could help us predict future changes? On this edition of UWM Today, we're going to talk to two UWM scientists looking at when the Earth went from an ice house to a greenhouse. Joining us in the studio is John Isbell, a professor of geosciences at UWM, and with him, Eric Gulbranson, a postdoctoral researcher also at UWM in geosciences, and both of these gentlemen having spent time looking at conditions way, way down at the southern end of our Earth in the Antarctic. Welcome to both of you, John and Eric. Good to have you on today's program.
Thank you.
John, let's start with you in terms of framing the discussion. You are looking for those breadcrumbs that might have been left behind from when the Earth did become warmer to see what we might be looking at down the road. Tell us about the research and exactly how you're going about it.
Okay. Well, I do research in a lot of the southern hemisphere across all the southern continents, but Antarctica is the main continent, the main study area that I work with. And I'm looking at a time frame when Earth last went from a ice house to a greenhouse, and it was a complete transition. We're currently in a environmental transition, and we don't know where that's going. So looking at the last one gives us insight into what may happen in the future.
And just to give people a frame of reference, how long ago are we talking about?
We're looking at it about 300 million years ago, going to as early young as about 260 million years ago.
So that makes it a complicated puzzle to unwind here.
It is. It's a little bit like a mystery. You have to go out. You have to find clues. There's no billboard saying, look here, or someone there to interview. You've got to, in a sense, interview the rocks and look at the clues that they provide.
And nobody, of course, no written history. So you really are doing research looking at physically what is left.
Yes, physically, chemically, and biologically.
Well, before we talk about exactly what you're looking for in those rocks, if you could give us some sense of what the world was like 300 million years ago. How cold was it, and what sort of change occurred that made what happened then perhaps relevant to what could be in our future?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was different. All the continents were together at that time in one large continent called Pangaea. All the southern continents were together in a landmass called Gondwana. And at that time, the South Pole resided in Antarctica, not too far from its current position, about 200 miles probably from its current position. In that time frame, we saw large ice sheets, but previous views have always been that they were a single massive large ice sheet that covered all the southern continents and covered much of this Gondwana landmass. And the things that Eric and I and our colleagues are finding is that it wasn't a single ice sheet, but it was a large number of ice sheets that grew and decayed. Not all at the same time, at different times, based on differing conditions around the globe for that. The ice, when it finally started disappearing, disappeared in the polar regions first and was left then at higher elevations and at little lower latitudes. And there's a transition in the polar regions to go from glacial conditions to where ice-free conditions, where you had extensive river systems and coal swamps and abundance of plants. And then as you cross out of the Paleozoic into the Mesozoic at about 251 million years ago, you started getting reptiles in Antarctica as well. So it started out Antarctica and Gondwana, much like Antarctica is today, and then transitioned into an ice-free continent.
Was the temperature in throughout the world constant? Did you have one temperature in both the northern and southern hemisphere?
It varied quite a bit. You go from extensive warm tropical coal swamps at this time in North America and Europe and parts of Asia. And then as you go poleward, progressively getting a change in the climate. And by the time you started hitting about 30 degrees south, you started getting small glaciers in upland areas. And then as you went farther and farther south, larger and larger ice masses.
Any idea why there was that variance? What was going on within the atmosphere itself?
There is a group of colleagues that we've been working with, Eric's PhD advisor, who's done a lot with CO2 in the atmosphere, and other scientists have looked at that. And that particular interval in time, there's a big dip in CO2 in the atmosphere. And each time there were sort of multiple ice ages within that one late Paleozoic ice age. But each time you went out of those little glaciations, you had an increase in CO2, and then as you drop back into another one, you had a decrease in CO2. There's also a lot of mountain building going on, providing uplifted areas. When you uplift an area, you expose more land mass to weathering. Weathering will remove CO2 out of the atmosphere. You had a different circulation pattern in the oceans because of this large land mass. You didn't have complete circulation around the globe or around the polar regions like you do now in Antarctica. There was a landmass blocking glaciation or that circulation. What was going on in the far northern hemisphere, because this supercontinent was drifting northward, Siberia was starting to move into a polar region, and that's a huge unknown. We really don't know what was going on there. But that's another area where Eric and I are traveling this summer and starting a research program in Siberia with some Russian colleagues.
Well, I have so many questions to ask, but I want to bring first Eric into the conversation. Eric, you're a postdoctoral researcher. You are looking perhaps at making this particular question of what happened back then a major part of your life's work. Do you think that's likely?
Oh, definitely. This is a very interesting question. A question that's very interesting to me. My main interests in it are really complementary to John's, but they're somewhat different in that I'm really kind of keen on understanding how life on land changed or responds to the change that we see or infer from the rock record. So my focus tends to be on plant communities in Antarctica that are 300 million years to 260 million years old. And I'm interested in studying how they changed and evolved over time in concert with these climatic changes. And so with John, what we do is we go out into the field and we look for these plant fossils in the basically on tops of mountains. And we try to describe them in the field and define what kind of plants we're seeing. In some cases, we actually have forests that are preserved. We actually have these fossil trees that are preserved in their growth position. And so we can actually apply techniques we use for modern forests to look at tree density and the amount of wood per area of ways to characterize what these forests may have looked like in the ancient.
So it sounds like a really, really nice combination here. You're, Eric, looking at what was going on top of those rocks, and John, you're looking at the rocks and beneath the surface.
Yeah, we really need both sets of eyes, if you will, looking at that to build the complete story.
So when you go out in the field, let's talk about that research. Where have you gone so far to do this basic research, this on-site research, and how did you know to go there in the first place?
Good question. In Antarctica, I'm one of the really fortunate ones, and I've been to a lot of different exposures. I've had 16 trips to the Antarctic. Eric has gone on two of those trips and will go on many more in the future. A lot of it's you got to spend a lot of time in the library talking to colleagues, reading, trying to find out what's been done. There's an Antarctic rock repository, looking at the rocks that are already there. It takes a lot of work to find out where to go because you're, in some cases, going places where only one or two humans have ever been. In some cases, you're going places where no one's ever walked on the rocks before. But it's not just Antarctica. I mean, we also do work together in South America, in Argentina. I just finished a project in Australia, and I'm starting a project in Brazil, and then together we're starting a project in Siberia this coming summer. It's trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together with not just the two of us, but colleagues from around the world. And we try to put together a team that can address it from two or three different directions to try to complement each other, to try to come up with what the plants were doing, what the plants chemically were doing, what the physical environment was like, what the fauna was doing as well. We also work with Margaret Fraser at UWM and in Australia and in Argentina, and so it's very complicated. But we're trying to find ways to address that from as many different directions as we can.
So you're really, in essence, both detectives. You're trying to solve a mystery here.
Yeah, and it's interesting because what we're looking at in the rocks, those are all the events have already happened and taken place, and it's our job to sort of take that and sort of look back in time and see what had transpired to create these events that we see in the rocks.
I'm really interested in understanding how these rocks that are literally hundreds of millions of years old, how they are still preserved, how they have enough evidence within them with all the weathering that has taken place and the like for you to be able to see the clues that you're searching for.
Yeah, certainly the further back you go in geologic time, you do sort of lose out on the amount of exposed land that you can actually study rocks of those age.
Because at some point they begin to break down, right?
Yeah, like either oceanic crust is consumed in a subduction zone or, like you say, the rocks on the land are weathered away and turned into modern sediment and gravel. And so we might travel to these really remote and diverse areas, but it's not because we spin a globe and we say we want to go to Antarctica. It's because our questions sort of drive us to look at a certain time period, and then we have to get the knowledge about where the best exposures of rock are, and then we try to work in these areas.
What about the snow and the ice? Is that an impediment for you to find the rocks that you're looking for? Have some of these rocks been buried up by the now frozen lakes and streams that are turned into glaciers?
Yeah, Antarctica is 95%+ covered by ice, and for us, we have to go to exposed rock. We don't core, we don't drill. We look at the exposed rock, exposed mountainsides, exposed cliff faces. And we've been fortunate enough in that it's a geologic setting where there is part of the continent's trying to break apart, and it's formed what's known as the Ross Sea. And as it breaks apart, it uplifts certain areas, and there's an uplifted plateau that's dissected by the glaciers, which is the Transantarctic Mountains, and it stretches across the center of the continent. So for us, it's a natural laboratory. We just move from mountainside to mountainside, and this particular set of rocks that we're interested in is actually the most widespread of the sedimentary rocks in that mountain chain. So for us, it's a great place to go to answer those questions. everybody asks, why Antarctica? Well, Antarctica, and for us, is going there is driven by the questions that we're trying to answer. It'd be a whole lot easier if you could answer them in northern Wisconsin and just jump in a car and go.
At least they'd have Lineys up there, right? Not much Lineys down in those very, very southern reaches. Do you find with the climate change that is occurring today that your work is becoming perhaps easier because of the melting that's taking place?
Not really. There hasn't been in the eastern part of Antarctica as much melting and recession of glaciers. You can look at some of the pictures that Robert Scott did back in the turn of the 1900s, and you can still see snow patches in those photographs that I can see in photographs that I've taken. So there hasn't been tremendous recession of glaciers. Having said that, when I first started going back in the 80s as a student, you never saw liquid water, and now there's evidence for liquid water everywhere. There's lakes. There are streams, and it's changing. There are biomats that are growing on areas that dry out that you never saw 20 years ago. So that part has changed, but the glaciers haven't receded to the point where they're exposing new rock.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. A fascinating conversation today in our studio as we talk to John Isbell, a professor of geosciences at the university, and one of his postdoctoral researchers, Eric Gulbrandsen, both of them doing interdisciplinary research, focusing in large part in the Antarctic, but also other parts of the world, including South America and, as we heard a moment ago, in Siberia, perhaps later this year, talking about how the changes that have occurred in the world's climate hundreds of millions of years ago might provide some clues for what we are in store for as our world today continues to warm up. John, as you look at the results of the research that you have done to date, have you been able to draw any conclusions yet in terms of what patterns may have unfolded 250, 300 million years ago in terms of the warming of the world? Any evidence that helps you do some predictions of what might be down the road for us today?
Yeah, there is a direct relationship, or appears to be a direct relationship, on the time frame that we're looking at of CO2 versus the extent of glaciation. When the glaciers disappeared, geologically, they disappeared very, very quickly. There was a tremendous change in sea level that was going on at the time. Plants started growing almost as soon as the glaciers receded in the Antarctic. There are just a lot of similarities to what we're seeing today, and a lot of it has to do with changes in greenhouse gases and changes in ice volume. But we're really looking at and trying to refine the story. Before we came on the scene, there was this idea of this massive ice sheet, and we're trying to test that hypothesis, and we're finding that it's not true. And so, I mean, the first thing that we want to do is just to have an accurate history of what's going on, and then trying to relate that to trying to find what the drivers were that was controlling when the glaciers formed, when they finally disappeared.
When you talk about the rapid change that did occur a long, long time ago as the glaciers began to recede or to melt, what kind of timeline are we talking about? Hundreds or thousands or single millions of years?
Yeah, rapid is hard for us to communicate because sometimes we're limited by how well we can essentially tell the age of the rock. And so rapid might be millions of years in our time scales. Like these changes between glacial intervals and non-glaciated intervals or greenhouse climates, these intervals may be about maybe 1 to 8 million years in duration apiece. The transitions, it's hard to tell because we don't have good chronologic estimates for it. But what that does say, I think, is that it's important to recognize that these natural cycles are very long. They occur on very long timescales. And that actually is an important difference between what we're seeing with contemporary global change, where we're seeing change in, say, greenhouse gas concentrations of CO2 on the order of decades and centuries. And so that kind of begs a further question on what's in store for us in the next century. How will the Earth respond to this rapid forcing? But what we can say, though, from the rock record, by dating these, by essentially providing age constraints, is that we can say things about what were the major drivers of glaciation during the late Paleozoic, for example, 300 million years ago. You know, was it mountain building events, or was it actually climate change that were driving these glaciations?
We've had other glacial periods in our Earth's history. You think about the glaciers that were in Wisconsin, for example, the kettles and the moraines that were created. That was an incident or an event that occurred much, much more recently.
Yeah, it was. And we're still in that glaciation. It's just that we're in a warm interval during that particular glacial event, that they've receded out of this part of North America. But we still have large ice sheets in Greenland. We have Antarctica covered by an ice sheet or two ice sheets. And they're fluctuating, growing, and shrinking in part based on changes in insulation, that is the heat coming from the sun, that are driven by parameters in our orbit around the sun, plus the Earth wobbles, plus it spins like a top, and that changes the amount of heat that the Earth takes in. And those cycles, you can see advance of ice and retreat of ice. You can look at carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that are locked up in ice in the Antarctic that have been cored and have been investigated, and they fluctuate together. And you can identify what the temperature change was. And they fluctuate together up until about 8,000 years ago. And at that point, we should have been dropping into an ice age in a advance of the glaciers within our current ice age, because the temperature and the amount of energy that was being, or the amount of energy that the Earth was receiving from the sun was beginning to drop at the beginning of what should have been another advance. But as you track greenhouse gases, they suddenly depart from that curve and they start rising anomalously. And that was time when we started seeing humans developing agriculture and stripping forest. And that departure has caused an increase in the amount of many of the greenhouse gases that we haven't seen in millions and millions of years. And we can look back to when we had these levels in the late Paleozoic, and when you get very high levels of CO2 back at the end of the late Paleozoic ice age, and we went into that warm Earth, it was warm for 250 million years almost. Not quite that long, but 200 million years. So we don't know where we're going. So
what do you learn by going back and studying that the ending or the transition from that severe ice age 250, 300 million years ago? What do you learn from that time period that you can't learn or aren't picking up from these more recent ice ages, numbering 10, 15,000 years?
For my interest with the plant communities is that what we can see from modern forests is that we see changes in the northern hemisphere forests, in the boreal forests, and the hardwood forests. We expect to see that these forests are migrating poleward over time, and these are most likely driven by rising temperatures. And so an expectation might be that if temperatures continue to rise, that forests will migrate and cover increasingly more polar latitudes today. And why that's important is the high latitudes today contain the largest amount of carbon locked up as organic material in permafrost soils on Earth today. It actually exceeds the amount of carbon you could measure in the rainforest, for example. So what happens to that to that stockpile of carbon when you warm it, and if you were to, you know, grow a forest over that, is completely unknown. That may trigger an immense, you know, influx of CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, which would possibly exacerbate the climate forcing that we're seeing. Or there might be effects that actually reduce the amount of radiative forcing that we receive in high latitudes. But we just don't know a concrete answer to that question. So why it's important then to look in the rock record is that we actually have examples of these kinds of polar forests in the rock record. And where the rocks that we look at in Antarctica and the plant fossils we look at are one example of that. They are late Permian forests. They grew at about 82 degrees south latitude. And they grew during this ice house to greenhouse climate transition. So they're one of the best analogs that we have for contemporary global change concerning this increasing afforestation of higher latitudes.
Yeah, fascinating. John, as you think about your life's work and what sounds like will be Eric's life's work, any sense of how long before we more fully understand these questions? Do you think in your lifetime or our lifetimes we'll be able to fit the pieces together and solve this puzzle? Or are we some distant way away from understanding and unlocking the key of how what happened 300 million years ago might predict our future?
I think we're still a little ways away from being able to completely understand everything. But just seeing how much has happened in the last 10 years, It's amazing how rapid we've gained in the knowledge in terms of climate change and what's gone on, not only our current but past climate changes as well. It's an exciting time in science to try to be tackling big questions, but it's kind of like climbing a mountain. It's one step at a time, and to get to the top, you have to take hundreds, thousands of steps, and each one of us are taking some of those steps, and somebody else is going to have to take other steps. And I can take some. Eric's going to take a whole lot because he's still really young. But I like to think that UWM will play a role in that in the coming years.
And it sounds like UWM fitting in with a worldwide community of scientists looking at these same questions.
Yeah, very much so. I think right now we have, with students and Margaret Fraser, 9 people that are addressing this, and most of them are addressing it outside of Wisconsin, in South America, in Australia, in Antarctica, and now Eric and I trying to move to Siberia.
Just amazing. So, Eric, how soon before your passport gets filled up? Because based on what John has shared, I think his must be pretty thick with stamps now.
Yeah, I think I have about 2 pages left before... I'll have to get a new one.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's fascinating work. You're headed back, you say, to Siberia this coming summer?
Yes.
Siberia this summer. I'm heading off to Brazil in March. It was one of those areas that was covered by ice in the late Paleozoic. And then we're heading back to Antarctica come November.
Hmm. Well, how about if we invite you back after those trips and get an update on how far along we are to solving the great puzzle of what our climate might look like in the future.
Sounds good.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Thank you, gentlemen. John Isbell, professor of geosciences at UWM, joined by Eric Gulbranson, a postdoctoral researcher in geosciences, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. Well, that's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet the faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.